Thomas E. Bearden. Will you stay with us? We got to talk about, for a while, the weather wars. Hello, Thomas.
Hello, Bill.
How are you?
Oh, fine.
Is the weather still being manipulated a bit?
Yes, it is.
Give us an update, if you don't mind. And what we were talking about. You know, I just said the weather wars were manipulating the weather. Who's manipulating the weather, and what are they doing, and how are they doing it?
Well, of course, the Soviet Union has been manipulating the weather over the U.S. for some time. I realize that lots of our listeners have heard other broadcasts we've made, so I don't want to go too deeply into how they do it. I'll just say that the different kind of electromagnetics they use attached to the signals that come from the woodpecker transmitters, which are sort of like a big over-the-horizon radar and intersect over the United States. They use that intersection grid to create high-pressure areas and low-pressure areas and then move those areas around at will and divert the jet streams. That's the primary mechanism they use. And so by diverting the jet streams, they can give you cold weather further south, or they can turn the winds and the clouds and cause them to swirl and give you violent thunderstorms and tornadoes and everything else. And so right now in the southeast, they seem to be giving us a very bad drought. So that's the current situation, is they are keeping the circulations so that we don't get much moisture down the southeast. And the drought is really, really hurting the farmers. Unless we get more rain than we've gotten in this spring, a lot of farmers in the southeast are going to go belly up. It's really serious for many of them.
Well, Thomas, the last time we talked, and I, on this particular project of the Soviet Union and those that are trying to discern what they're doing, we looked at the enormously anomalous weather of winter before last. Did we see that repeated this last winter?
Well, this last winter, we had some anomalies, but not such serious anomalies as we had then. Apparently, they were using the grids for other purposes besides primarily the weather. I really don't want to talk about those other purposes on the show tonight, because I'll have a book coming out in about 3 weeks where I cover that in great detail.
I understand.
I really would like to divert that subject for a later time.
All right.
So they didn't give us the anomalies in the winter that we've come to expect in the previous winters. They gave us some real anomalies, which if you get the book, you'll see. But they have done some of it, and the biggest thing they have going this spring has been to zero in on us with this drought. This appears to be a determined effort to really cause some damage to the agriculture of the United States. And we've seen something different in this particular weather engineering. They seem to be using a bit more action in the earth itself as opposed to in the clouds. In other words, potentials, you know, you need 2 points, and it's the difference between them. You can either make that point up in the clouds, or you can make it in the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are doing an additional little component, or it's not a little one, a pretty good-sized one, in the southeast, in changing some of the scalar potentials of the earth itself. We have a person at the present time, who I'd rather not name, who's involved in trying to do something about that. We'll have to wait and see whether that's going to be successful or not, but he's doing what he can.
Yeah, there is a lot of work being done in this area, Tom. You and I can sit here and talk in very ominous terms, but there is work being done in the United States to counter this.
Yes, of course, I have to laugh, and I'm not laughing because it's funny. The problem is that it would be nice if it were being done by officialdom with well-funded efforts and, you know, teams of scientists and things like that.
Yes.
Unfortunately, that's not the case. It's done by lone inventors struggling in their backyards and in their garage laboratories and so forth with little or no funding. That's the real problem in this area at the present time.
Well, we have a problem with officialdom, because officialdom means a bureaucrat, whether he is civilian or military. And his first function is to never make a decision, number one. And his second function then is to check a book somewhere. And if it's not done, if it's not in there, then good, he's done his job and it goes out the window.
Well, as you know, the real problem in the whole thing, whether we're talking weather engineering or the Soviet development of weapons, or whether we're talking the struggle to get free energy in this country or cheap energy widely available for everybody, the real problem is the fact that we have crystallized what we consider to be the basis for science. And we have, essentially, in official science, we don't think that there's any new basis to be discovered. And we think we've got the perfect basis already established in what we teach in university. And, of course, that's the problem. It's just simply not true.
Well, I remember the head of the patent office in 1901 wanted to shut down the patent office because he said all things that have could possibly be invented have been invented. And he made that appeal to Congress, if you remember.
Well, that's true, and in fact, there are many, many such incidents. 2 years after the Wright brothers flew at Kitty Hawk, the publication Scientific American was still publishing learned papers proving conclusively that heavier-than-air machines could not fly. And Goddard, when he was out in the New Mexico desert, experimenting with rockets and building gyro-stabilized platforms in them for the first time and things like this, really pioneering rocketry in this country and in much of the world, Goddard was regarded as a lunatic playing with Chinese firecrackers, and in fact, he had made one statement that someday man would be able to use these rockets to go to the moon. And in the Pentagon and...
How dare him say something like that?
Beg your pardon?
I said, how dare him say something foolish like
well,
that?
Well, it earned him a nickname. In the Pentagon, he was referred to widely as Moon Mad Goddard.
Yeah.
And everybody would fall out of the chair laughing. Now, we laughed out of the other side of our mouth, of course, when the Germans started firing the V-1s and then later V-2s at us.
They have quite a monument to Mr. Goddard now.
Oh, now he's the accepted thing, as if that never occurred, you know, as if science had never ignored him. But in fact, he was ostracized by conventional science and considered rather much of a madman or a lunatic that had got in the hot sun in the desert too much.
Do we see a problem here in the United States of if it's not invented in the United States, it does not exist?
For a long time, it's been very fashionable in American science to consider... I guess I would say that they would consider the Soviets were really a bunch of ignorant peasants still trying to clean the mud off their boots. And, of course, that's far from the truth. The Soviets have always led the whole world in nonlinear mathematics and nonlinear aspects of science. They've always been great in nonlinear calculations and nonlinear theory since the very beginning.
Well, we now have a problem. It looks like, Tom, that a science has been thrown upon us, which you and I talked about before, and with your help, I wrote an article on in Let's Talk magazine, which, with your help, kind of explains it in a very simplistic way, that there is a science. It's an energy at a distance science that allows the Soviet Union to energize areas of our atmosphere, bend the jet streams, 90 degrees quite often, dramatically alter our weather, do great havoc to our agriculture and to our people, in fact. These weather storms that we had last year and the year before, there were many deaths involved. The data is in that this is not Mother Nature doing that. Is anybody listening to the science?
I think behind the scenes they are. They're certainly not saying that openly yet, but I think they realize, many of them realize, that the weather has just been far too anomalous for it to occur by a statistical accident. For example, the standard kind of estimate of how anomalous has the last decade been shows that you could expect that from nature only once in some 1,200 or so years. And unless you've just had a real fluke of nature here, something has been happening to us in the last decade. And, of course, that's the decade that since we've had the Soviet woodpecker signals turned upon us.
I was, we touched upon it before the last June 29th. Just one of those very unusual things that happens to a person, but I took some videotape.
Yes, indeed.
And I don't think that nature fills the sky with square clouds.
Not when it's a knife-edge square, and you did get a good picture. And I'm very glad you did, because, you know, as you know, we included it with your permission in our videotape explaining exactly how they do engineer the weather.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, that has occurred more often than people would think, but it always occurs, you know, when the person hasn't got a camera or something like that. And so to get one on video was really a good stroke of fortune. We have seen an awful lot of grids in and around other incidents that have been different uses of that same grid. Some of that, for example, will be described in the new book. Some of it has been seen right there in California by, for example, engineer Ron Cole. And that's documented. We've seen some grids down here, though not the classic grid like you took with your camera there. We've only seen the residue after the winds have been chopping at it for a while. But they have been still using the grid with a very high degree of activity, almost on a, how shall we say it, when you get everything reduced to just standard operations, just on a standard operating procedure. And I think we're going to see probably a little more of the weather control now, as they seem to be toning down a little bit, hopefully, some of these other activities. Unfortunately, I think that they are going to continue to try to influence this drought, and whether or not the individuals trying to do something about that succeed or not is yet to be seen.
I think we sent you some other photographs from a listener of this show who took some of the most amazing pictures I have ever seen of a cloud formation out over Santa Monica Bay, actually.
Is that the Al Matthews pictures?
The Al Matthews pictures.
Yes, they were a series of bars, almost like a draftsman had gotten up in the sky and drawn them there.
Perfectly laid out.
Nature normally doesn't make very perfect straight-edged bars like that. Normal wave clouds, of course, do widely occur and are well-known. But they certainly do not look like that. Those were not wave clouds of the normal kind at all.
I thought the timing of that cloud was very important.
Yes, indeed. And, of course, that's edging towards a subject I really don't want to talk about tonight.
All right. I'm with you on that one.
All I'll say is they have been using the grid in a weapons mode. Get the new book. I'll tell you all about it. There are some contributions in that book from some of the other researchers like John Dabini and Frank Golden. And we've done our best to describe what's going on over your head.
Well, I have a surprise for you. In the studio for me, or with me right now, is Mr. John Bedini.
Fantastic.
Hello, John. Welcome to Open Mind.
How you do, Bill? How are you, Tom?
How you doing, John?
Fine. How are you?
Well, it's pretty good weather out here. A little hot, but still pretty good.
John has been very, very involved with Tom in the this research and a lot of other researches, too. And can give some expertise to some of the questions that may come up, because we do want to talk about our weather wars update. The weather wars that we talked about has continued on, as you've listened to Tom. And, of course, then John has a lot of updating for you, too, on some of the fascinating world of the land of Bedini.
Yes, indeed. I'm very much interested in that, Bill, because I think John, as you know, from our discussions we've had recently, John has been doing some very, very interesting work indeed, and particularly in the thing he's calling optophonics. That's extremely important.
Well, I think it's probably one of the most exciting things that's happened. Here I am in the radio industry, but I'm also a person who sits at home and listens to my radio and my hi-fi and all of that. But the science involved in order to bring you another step in sound that is more important than the step that optophonics is to stereo is more important than what stereo was to monaural, right? And in a strange kind of way, and I hate to be mystic here, but we can't talk about a lot of the reasons that those things all interrelate to weather wars.
I think we can tell them.
They do.
I think we can tell them that John is, as everybody knows, if I might use the term, a scalar engineer, because he is doing scalar electromagnetic engineering of the most basic kind that you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And the most fundamental kind. I think we can certainly point out that he's applied some of this extensive knowledge he's gained over the years, he's applied that in the optophonics, and it certainly shows.
What I want to do, Tom, is take a little break here. I know the callers are beginning to line up to talk to you. We want to go over the weather wars thing as much as we can, because it is and has been for some time a serious problem. There have been a lot of questions that have been asked of me since your last appearance talking about it and the article that you and I wrote in Let's Talk Magazine. And give the folks a chance to go, you know, nose to nose with you, if we may, because I don't pretend to know how to answer these questions.
Okay.
I can say the words that you have taught me to say. I can't say that I know exactly what they mean.
Okay, we'll have a go at it.
All right. Let me give the numbers. If you'd like to talk to Tom Bearden tonight about a new kind of science that is being employed against us, all of the data seems to suggest that. Let me give you the numbers. In Los Angeles, talk about the weather wars for a lot. We have a lot of things to talk about tonight with John and Tom. But William is on the line. Hi, William.
Hello.
Hey.
I had a question, a comment. I'm wondering about the possibility, he may not want to talk too much about this, but he might be able to confirm it. Each particular element in nature has a resonance vibration. And using this, what did they call it, vibrasonics? What did he call it?
Optophonics.
Optophonics. Could it be possible, for instance, to change or disable the reactions, say, in a nuclear device?
Let me answer that fairly briefly by saying you have two kinds of resonance. You have the normal electromagnetic resonance we all think about, and of course, in physical matter, we have things like sound resonance and other kinds like that.
Correct.
But by and large, in space-time itself, in the actual space-time that a piece of matter or something occupies, you have a scalar resonance, or it's really a purely gravitational resonance. It consists usually of a group of frequencies, rather much like a Fourier expansion. Any kind of physical process or any kind of physical device in its operational form and in its operation has key resonances like that in the gravitational area. Now, since we don't do any kind of gravitational engineering in orthodox science, they don't measure anything like that at all. They don't even have a gravitational detector that'll do that. But you can use the scalar electromagnetics, which is purely electrogravitation, and you can measure and detect those kinds of frequencies and those kinds of patterns.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you hit or augment those frequencies with scalar electromagnetics, you are now augmenting the frequency or the amplitude of each wave in a gravitational manner, and you can damage or blow up or destroy any kind of thing like that. Also, the basic mechanism for a most deadly danger of nuclear material, that really the danger was originally pointed out by Reich in his experiments with orgone energy, which was scalar electromagnetics. Nuclear material is particularly susceptible to this kind of effect. And the reason is condensed matter already has a gravitational potential with reference to the vacuum around it. And so in condensed matter, if the nucleus is unbalanced, there are resonances trying to break up inside the nucleus in that potential that's already up above the ground. In other words, as you can see, you have an unstable situation. It's sort of like something vibrating on the edge of a big cliff. If it ever reaches the edge of the cliff, it's going to fall off, and the nucleus then would decay. If you hit that nucleus with a sharp rise in potential, now this is electrogravitational potential, that nucleus will immediately go bananas. It will immediately decay in most cases. Certainly, if you have radioactive material, you will have a very large surge and decay immediately. And anything nuclear, when the electrogravitational pulses, scalar electromagnetic pulses, are being bandied about, anything nuclear presents a very deadly danger. If anything nuclear gets one of those pulses, it's a pretty big pulse. All the little radioactive nuclei are going to go full nuclear or almost full nuclear right away and decay. And you're going to get an extreme burst of radioactivity. It doesn't matter if it's a nuclear warhead in storage, in a missile, or if it's a nuclear reactor. And so all the nuclear facilities on the face of the Earth today represent really extreme danger to the whole human species from the use of scalar electromagnetic weapons, as evidenced by the Soviet Union.
Is there any question, if you don't mind me breaking in here, William, just a second. I was listening to what Tom just said.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems very poignant, particularly with the history of the last 3 weeks. That the nuclear reactor up in the Ukraine should have had its problem, which it shouldn't have had. It had worked for a long, long time. Now, we know that the Soviets are playing with scalar. Tom, do you have any...
Well, the only conclusion I can draw is that they had a drastic nuclear accident before, in the winter of 57, 58, apparently.
Yeah, up in the Ural Mountains.
Up near the Urals. And what happened there was, according to eyewitnesses in the area, people from the area itself, it was stored radioactive waste material which exploded.
A waste dump.
A waste dump. Now, that makes sense. We know that in 1960, Khrushchev announced they were playing with these fantastic weapons. In other words, they were well along in research and development. We know they went operational in 1963. So in 1957, they were in research and development with these things. And the kind of accident you could have had would have been if you had a big transmitter you're playing with and you had built up one of these powerful standing scalar waves, which is what you use, standing waves. The more energy you put into that thing in the form of gravitational energy, the more the amplitude of the wave in your standing wave. A peculiar effect comes out of that. If you have a failure in the transmitter, just a common garden variety, ordinary, everyday failure, all of that energy that you've got connected to you is connected through your equipment into the grounding of your electromagnetic equipment, in the ground itself. You will get a discharge of that gigantic standing wave energy, just like you had a very huge Tesla coil or a tremendous capacitor shorted out to the ground. In the ground, then, you will get not an electromagnetic pulse, not an EMP, but an electrogravitational pulse, an EGP. And the first nuclear thing close to that is going to go bananas. It's going to go with an extreme pulse of radioactivity. And that's what happened, I believe, in 1957-58. I think they were playing one of these things. They had an ordinary garden variety failure. They got an EGP in the ground. The nuclear waste nearby exploded and contaminated that whole vast area, which is contaminated to this day.
To this very day. You know, it just dawned on me, Tom, the last time we talked, it was shortly after May Day of a year ago, in which we saw an enormous amount of activity on the part of the Soviets.
Yes, as you recall, in May Day, Gorbachev had taken power, of course, as a new leader. He hadn't been in there too long. And what apparently happened that particular year, 1985, was their 40th anniversary of the ending of World War II, which was a very big thing to the Soviet Union. They lost millions and millions of people in World War II.
Yes.
So they had a very a gigantic celebration for the end of that war, their 40th anniversary. And one of the things that happened was they activated the entire, with a giant exercise, they activated the entire scalar weapon system, the big monsters that they have. One of the simple little things they did, which was monstrous, and I simply cannot describe what kind of a feeling it gives you to stand and look at a screen with 54 different frequencies upon that screen, signals, if you will, each one which represents the entire Earth beneath your feet in electrogravitational resonance on 54 different frequencies. Mother Earth itself, in monstrous resonance, controlled from the Soviet Union. And that occurred in 1985.
What about 1986? Did they do it again?
Well, It alarmed us in 1985, to say the least, because we didn't know whether or not they were going to move or what, but it was obvious that something quite different from anything else we'd ever seen or dreamed of was occurring. Then they started turning some things on and some things off, back on and off, and it became obvious it was a giant exercise of the whole strategic scalar weapon system. And we realized they really weren't going to move against the whole world, but just exercising the system. One of the things that's interesting about those 54 frequencies, I've been asked many times, how do they power the gigantic power that's put into the Tesla shields and things like that? Well, they do it very simply. You take two of those frequencies into the Earth, and as you know, you have a rather large amount of energy going on inside the molten core of the Earth, like a giant cathode, so to speak. All you have to do then is bias one of those scalar frequencies. You go in on resonances of the Earth. There are broad resonances there. These were in pairs 12 kilohertz apart, as monitored by Frank Golden, with a very special scalar electromagnetic detection system that he has developed. You take two frequencies 12 kilohertz apart, go into resonance through the Earth, into the molten core of the Earth, and then you simply lower the potential on one of your frequencies, and you can extract all the amperage and all the voltage you need right out of the Earth itself. And it'll be a 12 kilohertz frequency, which is what they were taking out of the Earth and using each of those taps. So there were 27 power taps going on as of May Day 1985 in the molten core of Mother Earth itself. And those gigantic power taps are used to power these weapons I'm talking about. I'm estimating that one power tap can power about six weapons, four to six. If that's accurate, then as of May of last year, they had activated well over 100 of these giant weapons.
And the weapons make all of the hydrogen weapons that we have child's play.
That's correct. They're one of the simple things you could do, for example, to show you how frightening it can be if you wish to. You know, Brezhnev in 75 used the phrase, more frightening than the mind of man has ever imagined. And in 75, it was so frightful, even the Russians were afraid and tried to get an agreement with the United Nations, with the nations of the world, as a matter of fact, to outlaw the development of such weapons. Gromyko actually introduced into the United Nations such a draft agreement and asked for signatures. And Article 1 of that agreement said, we'll negotiate the type of weapons we're talking about when we start negotiations on the agreement.
Okay, William, does that help you?
I think it does. That was the impression that I had, too, that these could be set off by exercising the natural gravitational resonances of the elements involved.
Yes, one of the deadly dangers, William, since you asked the question and you certainly have the intuition to see it, I'll go ahead and give you, if you send a pulse around through the Earth, and it'll travel through the Earth as well as, you know, use a normal carrier to carry around the ionospheric waveguide, you can send it through the Earth, and you can focus it in across two beams, for example, in a place where we have missile silos.
Correct.
Okay? If you pulse a strong electrogravitational pulse in that intersection with the missile silos, you'll blow all the warheads. You can use your opponent's nuclear warheads to obliterate him.
You might also be able to then extract the energy and send it somewhere else and start a major conflagration somewhere.
I don't know just how far along they are at extracting something that's going nuclear like that. That'd probably be pretty dangerous. I really don't know whether they could handle that or not. The thing is, I don't believe the Soviets want to blow up the world. They want to take it over. But they're not fools. They do not want the whole Earth contaminated. You know, they need the farmland of the United States. They need the soil.
Well, if they blew the missiles up in the silos, though, they wouldn't really be contaminating a large percent of the Earth, because we do underground nuclear testing now.
Yeah, but when we do an underground nuclear test, William, we dig a big hole way down deep in the rock.
Right.
So that we don't vent that explosion. We don't vent all that radioactivity. If you blew those things in the silos, you would vent all of that. You'd have monstrous tonnages of deadly hot dirt churned up into the atmosphere, carried around the Earth, dumped everywhere. You would have fallout on massive scales throughout the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, William.
Thank you.
One thing to remind, just to put in your mind, when is the last time we made a successful launch in the United States. And with that, I'll let you go. We'll be back with Tom Bearden in just a moment. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind on Talk Radio 79, KABC.